This episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. Stay tuned for details of how to get a 10% discount. Coming up today, Google develops a smart contact lens that could provide an early warning about glucose levels in diabetics' blood. Plus, injecting genes into the eye could aid development of treatments for blindness. And we ask the questions, is email about to die? Do we need Kim.com's new music streaming service? And is wearable tech fundamentally unwearable? All that, plus me for the first time in the month, coming up. Hurrah! This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting from science and tech to eyeballs and wearables. Oh, I like that. That didn't come out when I wrote that. That was quite nice. I'm Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Olivia underscore Solon.
And I'm Liat Clark.
And I'm totally back in the country.
Yeah.
You know what? This has been the first time in a month I've recorded a podcast in this studio. One whole month. That's a 12th of a year.
But you have sent us a little message from the floors of CES. It sounded like you were recording it under a blanket, perhaps.
I recorded it under a quilt in my hotel room. That is correct, yeah. But it's the best way to get that really nice damp sound quality in a hotel room. Yep. Is just wrap yourself in a blanket, sweat a bit, you know, do it nude if needed. Whatever's necessary. Whatever's necessary. We wanted to flag as well that our BuzzFeed issue of Wired is still on sales and has been causing some very interesting debates around the kingdom that is United, our beloved nation, so I've heard. So if your curiosity has not yet been piqued by the selfie-based cover, then do check it out. It's also out on tablets, of course, and you can get a 30-day free trial if you have one of those tablet-like devices. So wired.co.uk/magazine is the place to go. But now it's time to get into the news. The comet-bound spacecraft Rosetta, Liv, has woken up from its hibernation funsies.
Yeah.
So I read on our website this week.
Yeah, this is a European Space Agency spacecraft, and it's been in space for about 10 years. It launched way back in March 2004, and the aim of the mission was to actually land on a comet. In a rendezvous somewhere near Jupiter's orbit. And it took advantage of some gravitational slingshots provided by Earth and Mars, i.e. using their kind of gravitational pull to travel and use much less energy. And it's been trying to catch up with the comet ever since. But about 3 years ago, it was put into hibernation to try and conserve some energy.
Oh, like a little hedgehog in Rotherham.
Like a little hedgehog, but for 31 months. And this week, she was woken up. And it was all quite a tense few hours, actually, because at 10 a.m. they officially, the kind of alarm clock went off on Rosetta, and that was the kind of cue to start firing stuff up, start warming up. And she then spent several hours doing this and then orienting herself. I love how I've instantly anthropomorphized her.
Yes.
Started orientating herself correctly before sending the signal back to Earth, which took around 45 minutes. Now, it was meant to arrive at some point between 5:30 p.m. UK time, and this is on Monday, and 6:30 p.m. And she kept everyone waiting until 6:25.
I've dated women like that.
And then suddenly the signal was detected, and there was this huge uproar. If you're watching the live stream at ESA's headquarters, with everyone like applauding and getting very excited about the fact that this signal had arrived, because we've had cases like with Beagle 2 where we've been waiting for the signal and it hasn't arrived, but thankfully this one did.
So she's not actually collected any data yet, or did she before she went into hibernation?
I think she's just been journeying. The aim is to get to this comet. Yeah. That's her purpose. So it's been about conserving energy to get to this comet near Jupiter's orbit, which is very far away.
Yeah, the fascinating thing about comets, actually, is because they have been around for a hell of a long time and they have travelled some tremendous distances.
Exactly. So the idea is that comets can give us some amazing clues about the very origins of the universe. As you said, they're some of the earliest objects around, accessible to us within our nearest kind of space vicinity. They are some of the oldest things in it. But yes, the next step for Rosetta is to release a small little lander called Phi. I don't know if I've pronounced that correctly. Phiae. And that's going to hopefully land on the comet and then collect data, take images, and try and tell us much, much more about our solar system.
You know, when I was growing up, comets and asteroids were always the least interesting topics to me when we were learning about space generally. Yeah. You know, planets, brilliant, the moon, fantastic, supernovae, black holes, all that kind of stuff, tremendous. If we ever had to do a section on comets and asteroids, I'd be bored. I'd think, oh, this is going to be a disappointing hour. Whereas now, I find them to be some of the most fascinating things that we do any kind of work on, because we can actually start seeing potential benefits on Earth, whether that's asteroid mining or, you know, or stuff like this.
Yeah, I guess maybe you didn't think about landing on them at the time, which is...
No, whereas planets for somehow seems like, yes, we will do this. We've landed on the moon. We'll be on Mars soon.
Yeah.
Comet, get it. Eyeballs. That is the topic of our next slightly squishy spherical topic, specifically injecting genes into them, because there is a chance, a study has shown, it could be used to treat blindness. Liat, this is a story you have been covering for us this week.
Yes, indeed.
Which, despite its squeamish undertones, is amazing.
Yeah, it's
fill us in.
Really quite exciting. I think there's been a 12 people involved in a trial that has just, the results have just been announced, and their eyesight has quite dramatically improved because of this treatment. Now, it's a study that's been going on since 2011 by a professor at Oxford University called Robert McLaren, and it involves a quite a rare disorder called choroideremia.
I'm going to say well done. I have no idea, but I'm guessing that was pretty well done.
I don't know. It's a degenerative eye disorder, and it's the diagnosis is not good. Everyone, if you have it, you're going to go blind, and there's nothing really that can be done about it. It begins with tunnel vision, starts in childhood, and it just gets progressively worse. So they began this trial in 2011, and the whole point was basically to make sure that introducing these genes into the retina would not harm the retina. But what they found was it didn't harm the retina, it did stop degeneration, and it actually improved each of the candidates' eyesight, which is something they hadn't really expected. They thought it would kind of stall the progression of the disease, but it's done far more than they had imagined.
So how, in terms of improvement, what sort of improvement are we talking about here?
Well, I mean, this might not sound like a big deal to a lot of people, but it would be to me even, actually. But one guy, a 63-year-old called Jonathan Wyatt, could read three lines down the, you know, optician's chart further than he could before. Mm-hmm. And I think on average they said that patients could read between three and eight letters more. But these people, really, you have to kind of understand what their vision has become. They can't see really in low light. It's tunnel. Their range of vision is so narrow. It's just the retina is basically, it's the photoreceptor cells are dying. So the retina is kind of shrinking, and your field of vision has just become this very narrow field. And one guy kind of described how he could actually see stars again. You know, he, for years and years, he'd been looking up into the sky and, you know, just seeing black, and he can see stars again. And had, you know, he'd grown accustomed to the fact that he was going to go blind, let alone, you know, be able to see something like stars again. So
obviously very, very, very reassuring. Obviously, though, this is still one case and one condition in particular that this has been shown to be, it seems, successful in. So there's a lot of work, I imagine, to be done. Is there any confidence that this could be used for other types of blindness, other conditions?
Yeah, absolutely. It's basically based on the principle of reintroducing a protein that is not produced properly when there's a mutation in the CHM gene. And that protein is responsible for promoting cell activity in the retina and producing the photoreceptor cells, which you obviously need. They're the light-sensitive cells that help translate electrical signals into... translate light into electrical signals the brain then sees as images. So in theory, depending on what mutation, you know, what gene mutation is responsible for a degenerative disorder, it could be translated to other disorders. And I think they've actually flagged up quite a more common one, retinitis pigmentosa, which is an age-related, far more common disorder. And they think this has kind of promising hope for that, because with that, the key is that the retina is very thin, so you wouldn't want to trial it on these on patients with this disorder, because you might destroy the remaining retina. But they've proven, no, we did not destroy it.
Well, so, take a look at Liat's report on wired.co.uk for much more information on this. Search for injecting genes eye. Google has revealed information about an innovation its Google X Research Lab has been working on. It's a quote-unquote smart contact lens aimed at reading the blood sugar levels in the blood, of course, of diabetics once per second, with the ability to display that information on a mobile app in future if the levels detected drop below a certain healthy threshold. Now, this is an amazing bit of innovation, very early days at the moment, but it's something Google apparently has been working on for quite some time. It's still in its prototype but functioning stages, and Google is in discussions apparently with various people, including the US's FDA, Federal Drug Authority, I believe that sounds
Administration,
which regulates medicine and drugs, amongst other things, in the country. It's also in talks with charities over there. And nothing's been announced yet for a European or UK launch, but we understand the UK charities are at least aware of Google's plans. Now, the device works by reading glucose levels in tears, which does sound a little bit dramatic and emotional, but no crying is required. The eye apparently is naturally moistened by eyeball lubricant, and this fluid is one of a number of fluids the body produces that carries information useful to the kind of equipment and tools that reads blood glucose levels, such as blood, of course.
So this is, yeah, obviously replacing the pinprick blood test that most diabetic people have to do in order to check for their blood glucose levels.
Yeah.
I wonder whether, if you don't already wear contact lenses, whether this might be a slightly annoying thing to have to do.
I think it's less annoying than having to check your blood all the time, because this is, it's always there. As soon as anything fluctuates, you know, even veers to a dangerous level, you'll know straight away. So there's going to be far less chance of, you know,
thing,
going into shock. And
yeah, I mean, I'd welcome anyone listening who suffers from diabetes and has to do any of these tests to email us at podcast@wired.co.uk and let us know whether something like this would, you think, benefit you and how you have to monitor your blood glucose levels. I mean, from what I understand, a lot of the problems with these sorts of readings is that there's no amazing feedback loop involved in testing for diabetes. There are some machines, I think, that do blood readings from a finger prick, but the information they give is sort of very vague and doesn't really have any information. But because this can connect to an app, app developers could create tools that gave more useful and interesting information, and effectively in real time. You know, this prototype's doing it once per second, using a tiny little miniature sensor that's embedded between the two layers of a contact lens, as well as a tiny wireless sensor. Google, I think, has already talked about embedding tiny little LEDs into the contact lens as well. So you wouldn't necessarily even need to connect it to an app if it could sort of begin to flash red or green or some kind of thing in your peripheral vision that you would understand meant warning.
Yeah.
How close does it have to be to the phone in order for it to communicate the data?
Well, they haven't described that yet, and there was very little information when I called Google to find out. So I think that's the kind of thing we'll find out later. But, you know, I mean, the range for very, very low energy devices, you know, even something like Bluetooth 4 LE, which is what's used in a lot of wearable tech that we're seeing, you know, it goes for a few meters, you know, quite a few meters. So it wouldn't need to be that powerful if the phone was just in your pocket. It's more about power and how these things are powered, because you know, it could come where you can't fit a battery in this thing, so it's going to have to draw its power from somewhere else. Either, you know, it can be done with energy from your gait, I've heard, from your walk. At least the technology is being researched for that purpose, as well as from light, not necessarily just sunlight, but also artificial light. You can harvest power from that, apparently.
The study's ongoing now, where it's a similar thing, but using an implant.
Yeah. I think maybe fully implantable. I don't know how far that's still on down the line, but they have ones where you have a little, the pin is kind of permanently in your skin.
Yeah.
But it's a new chapter in wearable technology. Quite closely wearable, I would say.
Yes.
Which is interesting, because we're going to return to wearable tech in the second half of the show after the forthcoming commercial break. We're also going to talk about Kim.com, because he soft launched something called Baboom. This episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website or online portfolio. Now, for those who don't remember from previous sponsorships, Squarespace offers free domain names, which is handy, customizable website designs, drag-and-drop tools, 24/7 support, and if you want to sell physical goods or digital downloads like music or even podcasts, videos, written work, things like that, those systems are baked into all the templates so you can get going straight away. And as a listener, you get a bit of a benefit here because you can start a free trial without putting in a credit card. And as a Wired.co.uk podcast listener, if you go for a yearly plan, you get that free domain name and 10% off your first purchase by using the code WIRED1. So if you want to go for that, sign up now with a no-risk trial and no credit card at squarespace.com/WiredUK. Use WIRED1 so they know we sent you, and we thank them for their support. Welcome back. It's time for segments. We've got three delicious segments for you to chow down on and digest with your stomach acids in the mind. It's a weird image. And the first is, what's the point? This is the section, of course, where we put a big question mark over a news item. Kim.com has soft launched something called Baboom, Liv. Hilarious name. Do we need this is the question.
Was that the question?
That's the question I'm asking.
What's the point?
What's the point?
Yeah, well, Kim.com, the king of PR, I guess, and many other things, including
boats,
parts of
women,
boats, women, parts of
stuff.
New Zealand. He has launched a music service. Now, when we interviewed him in November last year, he talked about it a little bit. It's called Baboom, and it's supposed to be a sort of iTunes-Spotify hybrid. And the idea is it will let artists sell directly to their fan base and keep 90% of sales, and the artists can make their music available for free, with fans only paying if they really like it.
See, so far all I'm hearing is Bandcamp.
Yeah. And but moving on from that, he'll eventually want to launch a plugin that I think is quite interesting, which replaces the ads you see online when you're browsing about your, you know, your daily browsing habits with ads delivered by Baboom's own ad network. And this means that every time web users view an ad using the plugin, they'll be paid a small fee into their Baboom account. They'll slowly accumulate money, and I think he said something like, on average, it'll be about 10 albums worth per year, which they can then use to reimburse the content creators that are on Baboom. So they can pay for music without actually having to part with their hard-earned cash.
He's quite the dreamer, this Kim.com, yeah. Isn't he?
This all relies on more artists than he himself wanting to put their music on it.
Yeah, exactly. And artists who aren't already tied into big contracts and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, it has now launched. And it has launched with only one artist on the site. And that artist is Kim.com.
With the world's greatest album cover.
Yeah, he has launched with his album of electronic dance music, or EDM, as the Americans like to call it, called Good Times. And it's on the site. You can listen to it. It's pretty cheesy, but also amazing in many ways. And he's saying that he's launched only his album on it because he wants to lead by example. He's gone through the process of making an album and all the work that entails, using lots of different producers, including Prince Board from the Black Eyed Peas. And now he is offering it up for free on his own website. And he's urging people to make his album number one. So far, he hasn't. It's, I think, in the fifth position in the New Zealand charts on iTunes.
So he wants to lead by example. He wants artists around the world to say, .com, you're right.
Well, he wants to lead by example, showing that he's created content that he wants to offer up for free, but he wants to show that just because you're offering it up for free doesn't mean that people won't also pay for it. So he's saying it's free on Baboom. Currently, you can buy it on iTunes, Amazon, and wherever else he's selling it. You can buy it there and get my album to number one to prove that, you know, free downloads does not equate, you know,
or to prove that he is the master of self-promotion marketing. Yeah.
Well,
and this is utterly pointless.
I feel it would have had more impact if, well, it wasn't just him, obviously, and that the rest of the service wouldn't be rolled out in a year's time.
Yeah, he's saying it's kind of a bit vague. When we spoke to him, he said it would be a few months afterwards. Now he's saying something more like end of 2014. Mm. So there's a long time with just him on the site, which is kind of amusing. And it's, you know, a great stunt.
Yeah.
But I think we'll have to wait and see until this plugin launches, till more people sign up, if they want to sign up.
I think he's an absolute genius,
yeah.
Kim.com. I really do. What a brilliant way of promoting your album, that create an entire music service so you hit all the technology headlines and you're the only thing for sale.
Yeah.
Honestly, I take my hat off to him. I've left my hat on my desk, but I'll put it on later and then take it off again, because I think this man is an absolute genius.
But however, he surely believes in it too. He's not just,
I'm sure
it
he
as
does,
a stunt,
but
you know.
He does, and you know, it's good that he's taken this time out of his busy political schedule to launch something like this. I think the man's an absolute genius, and I'll shake his hand one day. But on the other hand, literally, in fact, perhaps when I'm not shaking his with, this is incredibly pointless, doesn't serve any benefit to anyone, and I don't see what's that new about it.
I think as it stands, I agree with you, but I do think there's something really interesting about the idea of this plugin, which allows users to generate money by looking at ads. I think that's something really interesting that hasn't really been done before, and to be able to use that music to pay content creators for their work is can only be a good thing.
Well, let's keep our eye on that, and we'll return to this when there are more than one albums available. Okay, people, buckle up, saddle up. Grab those reins, be comfy in those stirrups. We're going to ride the Technosaurus. Lady Geek Belinda Palmer wrote a guest post on our website this week about why she thinks wearable tech is unwearable. And she thinks that most of the CES products that were wearable were ugly and designed without adequate consideration for how people feel wearing them. This is my interpretation of what she said. And don't properly serve a purpose well enough to justify their clunky aesthetic. Most of that I agree with. I think that wearable tech at CES was clunky, not particularly attractive, and definitely appealed mostly to the geek niche rather than the masses that they need to appeal to. So I thought we could have a little chat about this, and I wanted to see what you guys felt about this guest article and also the wearable tech we've seen so far, whether that's smartwatches, Google Glass, or things like that. And I first thought I would throw my hat into the ring, which is that a lot of the tech that I saw at CES that was wearable was quite clunky, took an existing form factor like a watch, and displayed information that could be just as easily displayed somewhere else without losing any real usefulness. But one of the most interesting things that I think I thought about when I was looking at these devices is how all the watches were designed to be worn face up, even though they're displaying really personal information.
Yeah.
Why are none of these designed to be worn face down with something a bit more attractive or interesting on the side that is facing out? And it got me thinking, there was this device called the Yota Phone, which was, I think it's Russian, it was kickstarted. And it's not an amazing device, but it has one interesting aspect to it, which is that one side has a color touchscreen, just as regular phones do. On the rear of the device, it has an e-ink screen, just like a Kindle. Mm. And you can do various things with that e-ink screen that has much longer battery life, like reading a book, so you don't need to fire up the color backlit LCD. And it got me thinking, if these devices actually could have an e-ink face on one side that just told the time, but a color face on the other side that you rotated when you needed to see useful information, whether that's a text or an email or a video or whatever it might be. I saw nothing like that at CES.
Yeah.
And it struck me when I was reading Belinda's piece that this is the kind of thing possibly that could make these devices a little bit better.
When
what
you,
do you
say underneath,
think?
You mean...
As in
you know how some people wear their wrist okay, watches so that they look at it at their... You know, the veins side of the arm, if you like, rather than the top of their arm.
Yeah,
I guess it's even bulkier if you had to do that. There has to be a kind of more sleeper
e-ink
way of doing
pretty thin.
I think Belinda flagged up one device in particular called the Neptune Pine that a lot of people have been sort of raving about. But if you look at a picture of it, it is absolutely ludicrous. It is maybe four times the size of any watch you'd wear, and maybe yes, it's managed to incorporate actual kind of phone-like functionality into a watch-like device as opposed to just having to tether with your mobile phone. But in terms of what it looks like, it's massively ugly. And I think this is a slight problem. As soon as things start to actually be part of your body or on your body as opposed to being a device that you carry around. I mean, of course, devices do say a little bit about who we are, but when you're wearing it as almost a piece of jewelry, I think a lot more consideration has to be had relating to fashion as opposed to pure engineering.
I agree, but this is where I begin to start disagreeing, because I don't think these things are being worn as jewellery. I would happily wear a bulkier device like this than perhaps Belinda would be comfortable wearing if it did serve a function that I particularly valued. Because I would very happily, for example, have a camera built in, a forward-facing camera, so I could watch, you know, do a FaceTime, Skype-type call on there. Not everyone would, but I would actually find that to be quite interesting if I was just sort of sitting down with my arms on a desk.
Yeah, but you're an early adopter, though.
Exactly.
But even if it's hugely bulky, the point of these things is it has to be easy and natural because, you know, like your clothing, you don't wear an item of clothing that's terribly uncomfortable.
But phones have been bulky and for a while.
But I think the thing... Bag or your pocket,
yeah, you hide
it
away. And if phones were bulky, where people have commented on this piece saying, oh, well, just think about wearables now as like the phones in the late 80s, whenever mobile phones
were
first
launched.
But
they were cool in the 80s.
But they were cool, and that was really cutting edge in the 80s. The problem is now we're so used to very discreet, small, beautiful devices that then to have something ugly and clunkier than you expect to have on the body makes it a bit awkward. I think I feel as though there's something a little bit like the uncanny valley at play here. So we, you know, compare, as the devices have got smaller and better and slicker, we've been comparing them to the previous bigger devices. And now they're on our body, we're comparing them to jewellery or kind of objects, beautifully engineered objects like actual watches. So suddenly they're falling short of those sorts of things, even though they're amazing and impressive feats of engineering to be so small. And I think this is the most evident with something like Google Glass, which, you know, I myself wear glasses. I find finding the right pair of glasses a bit of, you know, a challenge. Yeah. When I found them, I still feel a bit awkward wearing them. And to then have an extra clunky, weird piece of kind of technology attached to them.
Just to say that one shape, one style is going to fit everyone.
But this is the thing, that everyone forgets this. Google Glass is a prototype. It's not a commercial product. It's a proof of concept that happens to function, and it's being designed to be sold to developers to create apps for it. It's not the design that will go on sale. It's not the version you'll see on the Google Play Store.
But most of these things are testing the water anyway.
They are. It's about finding out if there's a market.
They are all essentially prototypes.
But I don't think
this isn't going to be the final thing that you see being the moment where wearables is uptaken to such an extent that a smartphone is.
Mm. But I just think that, you know, when you're putting something on your body, much, much more attention needs to be paid to the aesthetic as opposed to simply the engineering.
Yeah, it's very personal. You're making a statement. And, you know, today it still is. When you see someone with Google Glass, it's like they're making a bit of a show and a statement, like, hey, I'm cool, I wear them 24/7,
I agree,
using my Google Glass. You don't just see a man on a street wearing some glasses.
I think it's sometimes there's a similarity here between, you know, who is designing these, because with all due respect, engineers aren't necessarily great designers and vice versa. And you can see that with things like a interface for a television menu. Those menus are not created by designers necessarily. They're created by people that make those products. It's like the product names you see on televisions. It's like a 16-string digit of letters and numbers, because it just represents different bits of the technology.
I was just talking about this the other day. Why don't they give them like fun names and then you'd remember it? And then
I wrote a very dry article
tool
about that, like, a couple of years ago.
Because I was looking for a TV and I was like, why is it called FX7SYZ? If it was something really, like, you know, stood out in the adverts, you know, I'd probably be sucked right in.
One digit stands for the model, one's for the panel, one's for the size.
But we don't need to know that. Put it in the box.
We're digressing. Let us know what you think about wearable tech from an aesthetic point of view, and whether you think the balance of aesthetic to function is currently imbalanced, if you like, as Belinda was saying. And at the very least, go and check out her article, because I think it has the potential to divide some opinion, and it's a very interesting read. Search for Wearable Tech is Unwearable on wired.co.uk. The last section. Oh no, they didn't. We wanted to talk very briefly about something one of the Facebook co-founders said, which is effectively that email is about to die. We're at peak email, like peak oil. We've got to the tipping point and it's on its way down. Liat.
Yeah, I mean, it also helps that he has started a company that is based on, you know, the demise of email, Asana.
How convenient.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we should point out, we're using this story as a way to talk about whether we think email sucks or not. So let's keep that with a pinch of salt in mind.
Well, yeah, he set up his company after, like, transforming Facebook's instant messaging service and kind of, you know, arranging your feeds according to who you think is more interesting. And he's trying to translate this in a business environment, really. And yeah, pretty much just thinks email is dead. We don't need it anymore. What we need, the interesting thing about their system is they don't recognize people as nodes. So, you know, you talk about the social graph. Theirs works on the work graph, and the nodes in their network are tasks, not individuals. And he thinks that this is going to, you know, transform it. And apparently he says it takes him 15 minutes to go through his system using Asana, but that is because not many other people are using it. And he actually uses
more about
email separately.
Workflow management as opposed to communication.
Email is incredibly inefficient in many ways, but it is also very efficient.
I don't know how that would work in our context of our work, because we obviously get lots of different, we get many, many emails from lots of PRs, lots of contacts. They are not workflows that exist already if it's a new contact who's coming in. I mean, today I had a great story about a guy making music using data from the Voyager spacecrafts. That was a contact I'd never had before. How would that fit into my tasks?
Email is not going anywhere while there is no suitable replacement that is platform agnostic. The reason email has been so successful, the reason text messaging has been so successful, is because it doesn't matter what platform you're sending from or sending to. You know that if you send an email to somebody, they're going to be able to open it, by and large. The same with a text message. We're not even seeing that happen with over-the-top messaging services. You know, are you on WhatsApp? Are you on iMessage? Are you on XYZ? There's no universal standard protocol for those, like there is with, say, Jabber on IM, instant messaging, which Facebook actually did adopt. But it's not quite there. And I think until there is, email's going to stick around. And I think he's not correct.
Yeah, I think his system is only going to work for internal messaging, surely.
Which is fine.
Like a big company.
There are lots of those systems around, though.
Yammer does that kind of thing as well.
Yeah. But I mean, Gmail does a pretty good job of organizing my email lately.
Does it?
I'm okay with that for now.
I hate the new Gmail. I liked it
when
I first tried it, and now I realize that all I'm doing is I have to check all the tabs anyway.
Yeah. Do you check all your tabs?
Yeah, of course I do, because it does work most of the time, but most of the time it's also sorting stuff I do actually want to see.
Yeah, but
so
I only check those once a week.
Was it in that chat? Was it in that tab? Was it in that tab? Where the hell is it?
Oh, what about the fact that it's removed the menu from the top, so you now have to click on that little kind of tile-based matrix to access Drive or Calendar?
That is a little bit annoying, but I have booked marks for all those anyway.
That enrages me. But anyway, we digress.
We do not think that email is dying yet until a suitable replacement is found. Although, I think we need to speak to some 12-year-olds about this, because Facebook, they don't even use that. I spoke to a kid the other day who doesn't use Facebook. He's like, why? All my friends are on WhatsApp.
Yeah, but they don't have jobs. That
brave new world. No, not yet, but they might.
How would the job relate to Facebook?
No, I just mean in terms of communicating, like, we rely on email.
Yeah, but they're the next generation.
They're all going to be...
They're not building their businesses on email yet. They're building it on WhatsApp and,
what?
You know...
So they're going to have public WhatsApp profiles where any PR can get in touch if you're a journalist.
Maybe. Who knows? That might be the
then
future of messaging.
Will become
as long as it's platform agnostic, then it could succeed. Let us know what you think. podcast@wired.co.uk. Send us an email. That's right. Email. We're old school and we're old people. I have a beard. Like, it's just do it the old way. Send us a postcard with a picture of the Queen in the corner. That's what we want. That's also where you can send anything to do with our show today, podcast@wired.co.uk. And we had one bit of email I wanted to read out, because last week you guys were talking about how to pronounce D-O-G-E coin. I was like you, Liv. I've always said Doge coin.
Yeah.
But I've said Doge because the meme I've always called Doge
as
well.
Yeah, me too.
The one with the little Shiba Inu thing.
Yeah.
But... we had an email from Keith who says, hey, as far as I know, the G in Doge, or that word, is pronounced the same as the G in GIF. And I love this email because I wonder if he's trolling us. Because
I think he is.
Debate over whether it's pronounced GIF or GIF. The answer, in my opinion, is it's pronounced GIF because the G stands for graphical. That's a hard G.
Even though the guy who invented it said it's GIF, but I think...
Doesn't matter.
Language is what people say.
Language evolves like anything else. And I think the guy who came up with the term is wrong because I use it differently. So anyway, thank you very much, Keith, for the quasi-trolling there. But I'm going to continue to pronounce it Doge coin because I'm set in my ways.
I'm going with Doge.
There was zero consensus when I asked. I had a lot of people feeling very strongly about their own pronunciation, but there is no consensus. So feel bad about it.
You know, the one way it isn't pronounced that you said last week, doggy coin.
Loads of people think it is.
They're wrong. Nothing. Find me another word that has O-G-E in it that's pronounced doggy. There isn't one. And if there is, podcast at
wide.co.uk. It, it is.
No.
It exists.
Well, then we're not we're not having this conversation again. It's just not going to happen. Either way, let us know what you think. Is it doggy coin? Doggy coin. I ask you. Podcast at wide.co.uk. We will be back here next week.
Bye.
Bye.
You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.
There was no sexy time in that piece. Unless you count Barbie Horse Adventure.